We are super excited because today's episode is sponsored by BarkBox.
As most of you guys know, my dog Mackie loves his chew toys, but they do not last very long in our house. And that's why we love our subscription service, BarkBox.
BarkBox is a monthly subscription box that offers an array of themed boxes for your pup. Inside your box, you'll find toys, treats, and unleash joy, thoughtfully designed to satisfy every dog's unique playstyle.
BarkBox has several boxes to choose from, depending on your dog's needs, such as the Super Chewer box, which was designed to challenge and engage your pup for longer-lasting play. And that's what we need for Mackie.
Right now, you can get a free extra month of BarkBox, which is up to a $35 value, by using our link www.barkbox.com/inhumanpod.
So treat your dog to what they love with BarkBox. www.barkbox.com/inhumanpod for a extra free month of BarkBox. What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. So I'm just going to dive right into it today because this is going to be a very long case, I think.
Yeah.
I have 14 pages, single-spaced, of notes. So
that's like the longest research I think either one of us has ever had so far.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. And you'll kind of find out why. I mean, it's a crazy case. There was a lot of information on it.
Yeah.
And this isn't even everything. There's some like details that I left out, and I will also like point you guys to where you can find those details at those points.
Right.
Because there was stuff that I left out. So.
Wow. Yeah. It's a crazy one for sure. There's a lot of details and just stuff. Yeah. I'll let you get into it though.
Yeah. So today we are going to be covering the very mysterious death of Christian Andriacchio. And I actually hadn't heard of this case. I don't know how I hadn't heard of it, but I hadn't. And a friend of ours, Britt, recommended it when I asked on Instagram for like case suggestions. So shout out to you, Britt, if you're listening, because I dove deep into this case and I'm now obsessed with it. And I'm really excited to be covering it.
Yeah, I did the same thing. Like I heard it on another podcast and then, yeah, I found out about, you know, the whole podcast that was on it, and I just like binged it, but I didn't remember it for some reason.
I know. When I listened, so there's a whole podcast about this case called Culpable, and I listened to it in research for this case, but in my podcast app, it showed that I had listened to all the episodes before, but I legit do not remember anything about this case. So
yeah.
It was all brand new to me, even though apparently I've heard it before. And before we get into this episode, I just want to let you guys know that this case does involve a lot of discussion of suicide, suicidal ideation, and graphic details regarding suicide. So it may be triggering for some, and listener discretion for this episode is strongly advised. If you are in crisis or in need of support, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255, or you can text TALK to 741-741. And for more resources, you can always visit the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention website at asfp.org/find support. And all of that I will put right down in the show notes as well. Let's get into this case. So as I mentioned, there is an incredible podcast about this case called Culpable, and that's where I got almost all of my information for this case. It's a full deep dive investigation into the case. So that's where I got most of my information. And the host of that podcast, Dennis Cooper, really did a whole ton of investigating. He interviewed family and friends of Christian, and he even facilitated and a more in-depth investigation back in 2018 and 2019. So a lot of investigation actually did come from the podcast, which is why I wanted to listen to it. Usually I don't like to listen to too many podcast episodes about a case just because I don't want to, like, you know, copy what people are saying or anything right. like that. But for this one, it's not just a podcast about it. It's literally like part of the investigation almost. I mean, not police investigation, but the external investigation. And it's super, super interesting. So I'd recommend listening to it. Like I said, I'm not going to cover all of the details. And at certain points in, as I'm telling the story, I'll tell you like which episodes of Culpable have more details on specific things. If you just like want more details on one specific thing, you can just go listen to that episode. So I'll be talking about Culpable a lot and talking about Dennis Cooper, the host, a lot as well. So Christian Andriacchio was 21 years old when he was killed by a gunshot wound to his head on February 26, 2014. He was found in an upstairs bathroom in his apartment, laying over headfirst into the bathtub. The police ruled that Christian shot himself with his own gun with his right hand and his head leaning over the bathtub. But many believe that Christian's death was not a suicide, and this case gets really crazy. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of background. Christian Shane Andriacchio was born on November 4th, 1992 to Ray and Todd. Well, Todd is, I believe, his stepfather. But his parents are Ray and Todd. And he was born in Dalewood, in the Dalewood neighborhood in Lauderdale, Mississippi. He had one older brother, Josh, and a younger sister, Alexa. Christian was described as the life of the party, and he was extremely friendly to everyone around him. He loved to ride dirt bikes, and he also really loved being on the water. In 2014, Christian was 21 years old, and he was on his way to becoming the youngest boat captain in Mississippi history. So he really loved working on the water, and he had worked his way up from being a deckhand to a first mate, and his career in boating really had a great trajectory at just 21 years old. When Christian was 15, he started dating 14-year-old Avery Smith, and they were together for about 5 years. And in an interview on the Culpable podcast, Avery described a time that they had kind of like become friends before they were dating, and she got scared during a jump scene in a scary movie, and he reached out and told her, as long as you're with me, you're safe. And that just like, it just shows you the type of person he was. He really just was very loving and such a sweet person, and him and Avery's relationship really blossomed. Her family loved Christian, with his mom or her mom even saying he dated the whole family, basically.
Yeah.
Everybody loved him. And at first, Avery's dad was actually like upset that Avery wasn't spending a ton of time with him anymore. But Christian like almost took that as like, okay, well, I want to win him over then because he's upset. And he did that. And Avery's dad and Christian ended up having a very special relationship. But sadly, Avery and Christian did break up after they kind of just were growing apart and they got older. They were going down their own separate paths. But both of them and all of their friends and family kind of always thought that the two would like end up back together.
Yeah.
So they, you know, Avery was starting to study vet medicine in college. So her free time was limited. And then Christian was working on boats. So it put a strain on their relationship. But after they broke up, Christian would always tell people that he would stay living in their hometown until he was at least 27, because that's when Avery would be done with vet school.
Aww.
So they broke up in 2013. And after that, things with Christian kind of started to change. Not everything, but friends and family were noticing some things. He was working on a tugboat in the area, and he began dating a girl named Whitley Goodman. And around this time, he also became friends with a guy named Dylan Swearingen. And Christian was spending a ton of time with Whitley and Dylan, and old friends of his saw his personality kind of start to change. One of Christian's longtime friends, Taylor, explained how Whitley was a little bit more on the wild side. Mm-hmm. And Taylor was starting to see Christian less and less as he was spending more time with Dylan and Whitley. Taylor didn't know Dylan at all, and he would rarely see Christian without Whitley and or Dylan tagging along. Taylor also, like after Christian's death, said that Christian never talked to him about depression or anything, despite how close they were after having worked on boats together for years. And he was absolutely shocked when the police said that Christian killed himself. So that's just like the first account of, you know, it not seeming like it would have been a suicide.
Yeah.
So when Whitley and Christian started dating a little while after, Whitley moved into Christian's parents' house with him. And Ray and Todd weren't huge fans of Whitley, but they did feel bad for her because she had told them that her parents didn't really provide for her. So they, you know, tried their best to be family for her and be supportive of their relationship. But after a while, her personality kind of changed from like the bubbly, sweet girl she initially was, and they were just getting more and more frustrated. So eventually, Christian and Whitley moved out of the Andriacchio's house, and they moved in with Christian's brother, Josh. Too many, like, shh sounds.
Yeah.
So they moved in with Christian's brother, Josh, in Meridian, Mississippi, which was a nearby city. They were living in an apartment, and Whitley would, like, basically still be living in that apartment when Christian and or Josh were on their 30-day-long hitches, which is basically, like, they would go out. I think of it as, like, a charter season. I watch Below Deck, so, like, it's, like, all about, like, boating and charter. And so, like, you go out for, like, 30 days, and you're, like, on the job, and then you come back.
Right.
So on the second to last job Christian was out on before his death, he actually was having Josh drug test Whitley to make sure she wasn't getting into any like bad shit while he was gone. And at one point she refused to like take the drug test and admitted that she had done drugs. And Christian at that time had Josh kick her out of the apartment. But of course, Whitley was able to like wiggle her way back into Christian's life by promising she wouldn't do it again, et cetera, et cetera. Like, the same shit over and over.
Right. Typical behavior for someone like that.
Yeah. And while Christian was on this hitch, Josh left for a new 30-day hitch. And so Whitley was living in the apartment on her own. And for some perspective, she was 17 years old. So she's now basically like has her own apartment and is living on her own. And this was all being paid for by Christian. So Christian and Josh paid the rent. Whitley didn't contribute at all because she was still in school. So she was, you know, getting money for the rent and the utilities. And Josh mentioned that he really felt like Whitley was just using Christian at this point, like didn't even really like him, just was using him for, you know, the money and being able to have an apartment. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And he was 21 and she was 17, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not like a crazy age difference, but definitely like, you know,
it's iffy at that age because, I mean, you're technically still a child, you know, in the eyes of the law.
Yeah.
And it's kind of crazy that she was even allowed to, like, live out on her own. I don't know what the laws are there, but, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Her parents and family were just, like, very, like, not there. They weren't. And that's why she had moved into Christian's parents' house originally, because she was just like, my parents just don't provide for me. Yeah. And so she just didn't have anybody looking over her. So I guess nobody like cared that she was living on her own.
Yeah.
So on February 22nd, 2014, Christian left for his next 30-day hitch. And 2 days later, Josh recalls texting with him, telling him that he should break up with Whitley and to stop letting her use him. And according to Josh, Christian was, quote, pretty dead set on breaking up with her and getting out of this town. So he had like every intention of breaking up with her and leaving Meridian and like kind of starting over, getting his life back. But he had just started on this hitch. And so he was, you know, out on the boat for the next 30 days.
Right.
According to Dennis Cooper, the host of Culpable, leaving a tugboat on the Mississippi River in the middle of a hitch isn't like the same as just picking up and leaving most jobs. There are a lot of questions why Christian exactly decided to leave this job when he did. And some of the information about when he left comes from Cheryl Stanley, who was a close coworker of Christian, and Christian actually called her his boat mama. And so they had a really close relationship, and she was explaining how things kind of went downhill with Christian after he started dating Whitley, just like how some of his friends and family had reported the same thing. And Christian told Cheryl that the couple was having problems and that he had kicked her out of the apartment for doing drugs. And once again, another person, Cheryl believes that Christian's death was the result of foul play. She thinks that there was some sort of insurance policy that Christian had, and Cheryl thinks that Whitley believed that Christian was putting her as the beneficiary on the insurance policy, which he actually did consider. He did talk to his dad about it, but he never actually did it. So the life insurance policy Christian did have, and it was going to his mother and his ex-girlfriend, but Cheryl thinks that Whitley believed that the money was going to go to her, and that led to something. That's just Cheryl's opinion of it after everything happened, but it's definitely something interesting to point out.
Right.
So on Culpable, Cheryl was interviewed, and she recalled the night that Christian left the boat in February 2014. Christian's friend Dylan was basically like reporting to Christian all this different shit that Whitley was doing, like messing around and, you know, getting into bad stuff. So Christian decided to leave basically to kick Whitley out for good and make sure she got out. And he actually told the captain of the boat that he would be back the next evening. So it wasn't like he was leaving and then was like going to stay home. Like he was planning to come back. Cheryl also said in the interview that Christian's Jeep was in a different parking spot than where he had left it when the trip began. So basically, like, he parked at one dock, the boat took off, and then at this point in the middle of the hitch, they were near a different dock. So he didn't have his car and would have had to go back to the original dock to access it. And so it's kind of weird that his Jeep was in a different spot, but it was still in that parking lot.
Yeah, like someone had access to his keys or something and moved it.
Right. But unfortunately, the security cameras in that parking lot were not operating, so we really have no clue what happened.
Shocking. Shocking. As always. I know. Ugh.
And then the last thing Cheryl talked about was just like her frustration that investigators never spoke to her or anyone else that was on the boat with Christian before his death. And we'll see a theme throughout this whole story of ways that the investigators didn't quite do everything, quote unquote, correctly.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Dropping the ball. Lots of dropping the balls.
Yeah. So on February 26th, 2014, around 2:30 a.m., Christian called a friend and coworker, a man named Justin Burns, asking if he could pick him up from his hitch. And Justin was like, yeah, I'll come. Like, he was close friends with Christian. He was like, yep, I'll come pick you up. But as he was getting ready to go, Christian called him again and said, never mind, I'm fine. Someone else is coming to pick me up. And in Justin's interview on Culpable, he said, quote, Christian said, I want you to know something. He said, bro, you're one of my best friends. I couldn't call nobody else at 2:30 in the morning for them to come get me. He said, I'll call you. I'll have somebody call you to let you know that I'm okay. Mm-hmm. So at that point, Justin was like, okay, something's up, but he listened to Christian. He had a family. He was like, okay, I'm not going to go pick you up because you told me not to. And, you know, it is what it is. Right. But now Justin believes that Christian told him not to come to protect him. Like, Christian was maybe worried. This is, again, what Justin believes.
Right.
But he believes that maybe Christian was worried that something was going to happen and he wanted to protect Justin. And he, of course, wishes he knew why Christian had told him not to come, but he'll never know. So we actually do know who was going to pick Christian up that night instead of Justin. It was Dylan Swearingen, the man who had recently become friends with Christian, when he started dating Whitley. Right. So Dylan drove 4 hours from Meridian to pick up Christian that night. And according to what Dylan reported to the police after Christian's death, Christian called Dylan around 1:30 a.m. and he left his house around 4 a.m. to go pick him up. And Dylan said that the drive home with Christian was like pretty normal with them, just like discussing, chatting like normal. But he also said that Christian told him that him and Whitley were having issues and he was returning home because of this. So it seems to be from multiple accounts that he was coming home to deal with something going on with Whitley.
Right.
So this whole following, this next account, it's all going to be from police, from Dylan's like police interview and statement. So this is what happened that day in, you know, according to Dylan. When the two got back to Meridian, Christian confronted Whitley about where she had been the night before because he knew from her phone location that she hadn't been at home at the apartment. And Dylan was listening to this argument from upstairs, the upstairs part of the apartment. And he remembers that Whitley did admit to being with another guy, Matt Miller, and said that she had used Xanax that night and couldn't remember what happened. And according to Dylan, Christian was repeatedly asking Whitley, "Do you love me?" And eventually, Christian took out his gun and pointed it at his own head and was asking again, "Do you love me?" So Whitley told him yes, and Christian finally calmed down. And then Dylan went and took the gun from Christian and hid it because he was like, "Okay, there's something going on here. I'm going to like go take the gun, defuse the situation, hide the gun."
Right.
Dylan said that the three of them settled in to watch a movie, and then Dylan left the apartment to kind of give the couple some alone time and also go get some food. And he said that at this point, Christian asked Dylan to go to the bank and take all of the money out of his account, which is just like really weird.
Yeah.
And he ended up actually not being able to take the money out because he wasn't like the account holder. So he wasn't able to do it, but yeah, just kind of weird.
Yeah. And what time is this supposed to be when all this is occurring? Because didn't he get picked up in like the middle of the night, basically?
Yeah. So they got home around like 9 or 10 in the morning, I believe.
Okay.
So this was like a little bit after that, you know, 11, 12 o'clock ish. There's not like a specific timeline. Actually, hold on. That's wrong. I heard in one of the Q&A episodes of Culpable that the Chick-fil-A receipt was at 1:06 p.m.
Okay.
So it was like, they got home. I think they got home around 11, I want to say, because it was like a 4-hour drive. So he drove 4 hours and then had to drive 4 hours back. So yeah, I think they got home around 11 and then this whole like argument happened. And then finally Dylan went and got food.
Okay. It's just weird because like no one slept.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then he just stayed, like hung out after all that. I would have awkwardly been like, okay, I'm going to go home now.
Yeah. It's not like Dylan lived in the apartment with them. Like he just stayed there.
Odd.
So yeah, it was weird.
Yeah.
Yep. When Dylan got back from getting the Chick-fil-A, everything seemed more or less normal. And Christian and Whitley then left the apartment to, quote, take a ride. Later, Dylan had woke up from a nap. He, you know, had fallen asleep because he hadn't slept while they were gone. And he found Whitley asleep in the apartment and Christian was smoking in the living room. So after that, Dylan said that he left the apartment to go check out some speakers at Best Buy. But before he left, he took Christian's gun out of the hiding spot that he had put it in and gave it back to Christian and told him, hey, like, unload it, but here's your gun. Which, like, that's
suspicious.
Yeah.
Covering your own weird ass. Yeah.
Yeah. Why would you take the gun out? And you left earlier and kept the gun in the hiding spot.
Yeah.
So why does Christian need his gun? If you're just running out to Best Buy and you're going to be back, why would you need to give it back to him now? Give it back to him the next day or, like,
right,
you know, when he leaves back for his hitch, not randomly before you go run to Best Buy.
Especially because, like, even though things, you know, according to him, seemed normal, like they're getting Chick-fil-A, they're watching a movie, everyone's like going to sleep and hanging out, I would still be apprehensive to give him back his gun if that really did occur, that things are still heated and something could transpire while I'm gone. So that, yeah, that doesn't add up at all unless you like wanted him to kill himself.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. No, definitely suspicious.
Yeah.
So when Dylan returned back to the apartment from this little Best Buy outing, he assumed that Christian was in the bathroom showering because he didn't find him downstairs and he saw that the bathroom door was closed. And he was like, Christian, are you okay? Like, what's going on? And Christian didn't respond, which, like, I mean, I go back and forth with this because I kind of get why you would be like, hey, Christian, what's going on? But also, like, this guy's your friend. If you think he's showering, why wouldn't you just, like, hang out for a little bit?
Yeah.
And wait for him to be done showering? But also, I get it. Like, there was a lot going on, so maybe you wanted to, like, check on him. I don't know.
Yeah.
So Christian was not responding, and so he entered the bathroom, and what he saw was horrible. Christian was laying face down in the bathtub, covered in blood. And Dylan then screamed to Whitley, who was sleeping downstairs. She ran upstairs and, like, dove down to hold Christian. And Dylan then called 911 around 4:45 p.m. So most of Dylan's story does check out with, like, surveillance and witness accounts. And, like I mentioned, the Chick-fil-A receipt. But he was never confirmed to be at Best Buy. But he also wasn't 100% confirmed to not be there. So, okay. You know, there's no saying whether or not he was there. But yeah, so that's his story of what happened. And now I'm going to tell you Whitley's story from her police interview and statement.
Okay.
Whitley did admit that her and Christian had trust issues, and those escalated when Christian left for this latest hitch. On February 25th, the day before Christian's death, Whitley claims that Christian told her he was quitting his job and coming home. And this goes against what we learned earlier from, like, Cheryl, the coworker, and also what Christian told the captain, that he'd be back the next day.
Right.
Whitley said that Christian had told her, quote, he felt like between me and his mom, he couldn't make anyone happy. So, She's saying, like, he wasn't happy. He was quitting his job. He was upset, all of this.
Lining it up to make it sound he was possibly depressed or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
So Whitley doesn't really tell an account of, like, what happened when Christian got home. But she says that she had fallen asleep and she had taken Xanax. So she was, like, knocked out and she was awoken by Dylan. And then she went upstairs and found Christian in a pile of blood. So she did not say that Dylan screamed at her and she ran upstairs. She's saying that Dylan came home, woke her up, and then Whitley, like, just went upstairs and found Christian. So obviously there are inconsistencies between these two stories. Whitley also never mentioned the incident that Dylan was talking about earlier in the day where Christian had held the gun to his head. And it's kind of weird that if that did happen, would she really not remember it or mention it?
I feel like she definitely would, especially if, you know, they're claiming he committed suicide. That could be a telling, you know, bit of detail to kind of lead up to that incident happening.
Yep. And so if we believe Whitley and that didn't happen, why did Dylan say it happened? So it's just, there's a lot of inconsistencies between their two accounts.
Yep.
And police also obtained text messages between Whitley and Matt Miller. And this actually, we later find out that these were on Christian's phone because Whitley's phone had been broken and they were actually deleted. There were some texts that were deleted from the phone and were later, like, recovered. But these text messages, and remember, Matt Miller is the guy that she had was with the night before and the guy that Christian thought that, you know, something was going on with. So in these, Whitley told Matt that Christian was kicking her out and was like, can you come pick me up? There were also 6 different calls from Christian's phone to Matt Miller in a 10-minute time span between 3:44 and 3:54 p.m. So there were these texts, there were calls, and Matt didn't respond until later and said, sorry, I was asleep. I had just gotten back from work and had fallen asleep. So police arrived to the apartment around 5 p.m. after Dylan called 911 and pronounced Christian dead on the scene. The coroner estimated at this point that Christian's time of death was 3:30 p.m. But like I just mentioned, there were those calls from Christian's phone between 3:44 and 3:54, which is why investigators believe that it was Whitley that called, because if he died at 3:30 before that, it was Whitley who was calling.
Right.
But again, remember, Dylan didn't return home until after 4 o'clock. He called 911 at 4:45. So this is supposedly before Dylan came home.
But after Christian was already dead.
Yes.
Okay.
According to the coroner.
Right.
At this point.
Which could be like within an hour, technically, because they don't, it's hard to really right. narrow it down like that.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that there were 6 calls from Christian's phone. Christian's phone was also used between 4:48 and 4:55 to call an unknown number, a friend of Dylan's and Dylan's mother. So this does make a little bit more sense because he called 911 at 4:45. And so Dylan, I don't know why he didn't use his phone, but we way, way, way later do actually get to hear the 911 call. And Dylan was saying, so like when I was researching this part, I didn't know this because this wasn't revealed until later, but I'm going to bring it up here because it makes it a little more clear. And like, there's no reason to speculate about these calls because on the 911 call, Dylan is saying to the operator, okay, like, you know, if you have all the information, I need to call the family. Like, I need to call Christian's family.
Yeah.
So that's probably what he was doing. Also, before we move on, I want to note that Whitley had Christian's phone when she went to the police station, and she didn't tell them about it for a while, which is just kind of weird. Like, she had his phone and, like, didn't be like, hey, here's his phone. Like, let's figure out what was going on.
Yeah.
So Whitley and Dylan went down to the police station and gave their statements, which is what I just went through. And Ray, Christian's mother, was notified of Christian's death. And at first, she didn't believe it because she knew that Christian had been out of town on his hitch.
Right.
So not just like, oh, no way, my son committed suicide. It was like, no, he didn't. Like, he's
working.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So Ray called her brother, or who's Christian's uncle, Chris. And he was the one that went to Christian's apartment to see what was going on. And when he got there, police told him that Christian's body had already been taken away. But they kind of like let him go inside and were like, it's not a crime scene because it was a suicide. So it was already ruled a suicide. And so Chris like was able to just go inside. He actually, as he was about to go inside, he was like, wait, 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 should I not go inside because of... I don't want to like mess anything up. And they were like, no, it's not a crime scene, basically.
That's so frustrating.
We also later find out, I'm not sure exactly at what point we find this out. I can't remember, but it took them 45 minutes to rule it a suicide. So they only like looked at the scene and like, you know, looked around for 45 minutes and then said it was a suicide. So Chris was, you know, there was a lot about the scene that kind of like he wasn't sure about. One being an extreme lack of blood splatter for what would have been, or what he thought would have been there if Christian had been killed in there. And also the fact that the gun was found on Christian's left-hand side, even though he was right-handed. So we will like get into all of this, but Chris did notice that. Chris also found it weird that there was a little tiny amount of blood on the outside of the bathroom door, which would have been on the inside of the bathroom if it was open. But according to Dylan, the door was closed and he found Christian inside.
Right.
So, you know, Christian wouldn't have been able to shoot himself and then close the door. But it also, there was a point brought up later that I don't know if I included it or not, but I'm going to mention it here because I remember hearing it and being like, okay, kind of to play devil's advocate. There was a lot going on in that like crime scene, whether or not it was a suicide or murder. Like there was a lot of like, the ambulance, or what are they called? Paramedics came in, and like Dylan and Whitley went in there and stuff. So there could have been some like transfer of blood because there was still blood. There just wasn't as much as Chris would have thought, but there was still blood. So that's could have possibly been how it got on the door. Mm-hmm. So just like, I don't know, when I heard that, I was like, okay, that doesn't seem as suspicious to me. There's other stuff that seems more suspicious. So yeah, we'll get into like more about the crime scene in a little bit. But first, there was one other very important thing that was reported by police. And this is one of the, I think, like craziest and the things that makes this case the most complicated and like varying reports and stuff. That is gunshot residue. So when you shoot a gun, there is like gunpowder residue on your hands. Mm-hmm. I've never shot a gun, so I don't know what that looks or feels like. So does it like not, can you like tell that there's gunpowder residue on your hands?
I have shot guns before where there was like a slight color, like discoloration. It's more of the smell right. of it, like the smell of the gunpowder on your hands. So okay. it depends on, I guess I'm not like a gun expert, but I think it depends on like the caliber maybe and like
right.
how much you're shooting as to like if there's actual visual, but there's, even if there's not okay. visual, there's going to be a testable residue on there.
Right. Okay. Okay. So yeah. So they tested Christian, Dylan, and Whitley, all three of the people that were in the apartment. And this is what they found. I'm going to break it down. So on Christian's hands, they found gun residue or gunpowder residue on his right palm and the back of his left hand. On Dylan's hands, they found residue on the back of both of his hands and his left palm. And he didn't have any reason to have gunpowder residue on his hands.
Right.
To be fair, if he would have touched the gun when he first found Christian, it could have transferred because it does transfer very easily. But he never said he moved or touched the gun. So he really has no reason. But he was never questioned about that.
Mm-hmm. And he would have no reason to touch the gun, you know? Like, you know, crime exactly. scene, you leave everything. I mean, you should leave everything as it is.
Yeah. And he, I mean, he told a very detailed story and he never said, oh, I moved the gun out of the way or anything like that. Right. So like, you think he would have mentioned that if it was something that happened.
Yeah.
And there was also residue on the back of both of Whitley's hands and both of her palms. And when they told her that they were going to test her for residue, she immediately was like, oh, I shot a gun last night. And that would explain why she had residue on her hands. And she said that the night before she was with Matt Miller, which she had said before, and his cousin Jet, along with some other friends of theirs, and they had shot guns in a field that night before. Jet later confirmed that Whitley did shoot a gun the night before, but Matt said Whitley did not shoot a gun the night before. So there was a lot of varying information about what happened the night before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's questionable. She had gunpowder residue on her hands. Whether that was from the night before or not is a huge question in this case.
And I feel like if she, I don't know, I feel like if you shoot a gun and then like, I mean, maybe she didn't take a shower. Maybe she didn't wash her hands after she used the bathroom. I don't know. But yeah. if you do that, like, I mean, it can still, I guess, stick around. But a lot of instances, I think, if you, like, are showering and washing your hands, like, it doesn't stick around that long, you know? Again, right. not a gun expert, but...
Yeah. I mean, just the fact that it was found on the front and back of both of her hands, like that's yeah. not just like on one spot. Maybe you missed washing that part.
That's peculiar.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Matt also told, Matt was only really brought into this investigation because he was with Whitley the night before when she claimed to have shot the gun.
Right.
And when he was interviewed, he also told, you know, police that Whitley had told him that Dylan found Christian and woke her up telling her I found Christian, which varies from Whitley's original story where she said that Dylan woke her up downstairs and then she went upstairs and found Dylan or yeah. found Christian.
Right.
Okay. Let me recap that.
Okay.
So Whitley originally told police that she was asleep. Dylan came home and woke her up. And then she went upstairs and found Christian dead in the bathroom. She is now telling Matt, this guy that she was hanging out with, that she had told police that Dylan was the one that found Christian.
Right.
So her story is changing. It's not staying consistent. And Matt was like, what the heck? But again, he's not really involved. And he, yeah. I think, probably wanted to stay out of it.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter to him who found Christian, you know?
Exactly. So at this point, Ray, Christian's mom, was completely unconvinced that her son committed suicide. She also didn't believe Whitley's story about shooting guns the night before. Just from what she knew of Whitley, she just didn't believe it. The Meridian Police Department kept a lot close to the vest in this case after they ruled Christian's death a suicide. Like I said, just 45 minutes after finding him, you know, family and friends kept telling them, like, hey, we don't think that this was self-inflicted. We don't think that this is what actually happened. But the Meridian Police Department never publicly investigated much more into the case because they had already made their ruling. The original lead detective on the case also, like, was super just not shady because he wasn't, like, doing anything bad, but he just was not responding to the Andreacchios, like, not. I think he was just, like, these people are just, like, trying to open an investigation into something that's a suicide and I don't want to deal with it, whatever.
Yeah.
The Mississippi Bureau of Investigation, or the MBI, did do an investigation after Ray kind of kept pushing for it, but they also came to the conclusion of a suicide. And the Culpable podcast covered the MBI's investigation in episode 7. And I'm not going to go into it for this episode because all we really need to know is that they came to the conclusion of suicide. But if you want to, like, hear more about the MBI's investigation and stuff, you should go listen to episode 7 of Culpable. But for our purposes, Christian's death was ruled as a suicide by the Meridian Police Department and the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation. So after this lack of support from police and the MBI, Ray basically went, like, full steam ahead and dove, like, straight into driving an investigation into her son's death. She was determined to get him justice and find out what actually happened. And she did try to work with the Meridian Police and the MBI, but it just didn't go anywhere and they had already made their conclusions. So she started working with private detectives. One of these detectives was Max Mays, who Dennis interviewed on Culpable. And Mays was somebody that had worked as a police officer and for the DA's office for many years. And then after he retired, he started working to help criminal defense attorneys. So he had a lot of experience in this. So he was helping, you know, starting to investigate the case. And he also had worked with a woman named Cynthia Speetjans. I'm not 100% sure how to say that. But she was a prosecutor that had then become a criminal defense lawyer. And she actually had a mutual friend of Ray Andreacchio and ended up meeting with Ray in 2016, 2 years after Christian's death. And once she met with Ray, she was like, okay, I need to help the family figure out what's going on. So it was just a coincidence that this private investigator, Max, had worked with Cynthia before. And then Cynthia was introduced to Ray, but these two started working on the case with Ray and the Andreacchio family. So Cynthia dove headfirst into this case, and she, you know, once she learned all the details, she did not believe in any way that it was a suicide, especially when she learned that the gun was found on Christian's left side, even though he was right-handed. And she was extremely frustrated by the police's investigation into this case.
Yeah, that's a huge, was it a red herring? Is that what they call it? A red herring?
Yeah, like, at least look into it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like every case almost that we have covered, they're not doing their due diligence. And I don't get it.
I know.
At all.
So both Cynthia and Max kind of became a big light in the Andreacchio family's lives because they were, you know, people who were, I mean, they weren't police, so they didn't have a ton of influence, but they were people who believed them and were helping them work toward proving that Christian did not commit suicide. So I decided to kind of dig into some of the evidence and forensics of the scene. Because I think that that's super important in this case. And it's also stuff that I find super interesting. Like, I actually wanted to be a crime scene investigator after I watched CSI Miami.
I could not do it
because, like, blood freaks me out. So I'm like, no, thank you. But it would be really cool.
Yeah. I just think it's cool to, like, I don't know. I feel like I'm good at, like, that kind of stuff, like, figuring things out. So right. It's super interesting to me, but yeah, the blood thing was like, nah, maybe I'll just not do that.
Yeah. Yeah, same. But we can still research and read about it. So I did kind of dive into this a little bit for this case. In 2016, the Andreacchios hired Michael Knox, who was a forensic consultant, and he specialized in ballistics and shooting incident reconstruction. So, you know, kind of makes sense for this case.
Yeah.
And Dennis actually interviewed him for the podcast and, you know, we're asking him about this report that he put together on Christian's case. So Michael explained how he does cover a lot where it's a suicide and the family believes it was a murder or like not a suicide. And he said, usually it does end up being a suicide, but in Christian's case, him and his whole team really did not believe it was a suicide. Michael explained once again how there was a lot of evidence in the case that was never really properly looked into or investigated. And during his investigation, Michael and his team went into the bathroom and used luminol to figure out where blood had been.
Yeah.
And they found evidence of blood on the ceiling and opposite walls from the bathtub. So it's just interesting that, you know, you wouldn't expect to see blood that high up or on the opposite wall if Christian had shot himself.
If he was leaning over the tub, or, I mean, I guess they don't know. Well, I guess they could tell if he fell into that position or if he was in that position when he supposedly shot himself.
Yep. There was also blood evidence found around a bullet hole that was next to the light switch. But that direction was inconsistent with where Christian's body would have been if he had shot himself and fell to where he was found. Mm-hmm. And also, it should be noted that there was a bullet hole in there in the wall, but the bullet was in the bathtub. So it's unclear what exactly happened because you'd think maybe it went through his head, then into the wall and stuck in the wall. I don't know if it would fall back out into the bathtub, but that wouldn't make sense if he was shot himself over the bathtub.
So the bullet that he shot himself with was found inside the tub. So it transferred all the way through, but then there was a bullet hole also by the light switch.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, no.
So it just was not a super consistent scene with a suicide.
Because even if it ricocheted, like you said, it most likely would have embedded into the wall instead of bouncing and landing it back in the tub. Makes no sense.
The gun was also decocked, which I did not know what this meant, but that is not usual. It like means the lever was let down, and if it had just been pulled, like Christian's gun, or the gun would not have been decocked. It had to be manually decocked, and it would have expected to be found hammer cocked or pulled up, but it was found decocked or like released.
Right.
And Michael, this investigator, did indicate that this was bizarre.
Yeah, that is.
So from his investigation, Michael's opinion on Christian's death and the evidence that he saw was that it was not a suicide. And of course, this is like the thing that I was like, holy shit, when I read about this. And I don't know why I didn't think about it earlier, but we wouldn't be talking about forensics and all of that if we didn't talk about rigor and livor mortis.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what rigor mortis is, after somebody dies, their joints will stiffen up into like the position they're in. And that usually happens 4 hours after death.
Mm-hmm.
Livor mortis is when blood basically pools on a spot that is touching the ground after death or touching a surface after death. So this happens you know, a body has to be in a certain position for at least a few hours for liver mortis to set in for the blood to pool. Mm-hmm. In Christian's case, there was liver mortis on the back of his calf, which was found at the scene facing up. Mm-hmm. So that would not be consistent with liver mortis because his calf would have had to be touching the ground or another surface for at least a few hours. Mm-hmm. This also means that Christian's death was likely way earlier than originally thought, and way earlier than when the 911 call was made. Mm-hmm. So originally, the coroner ruled his death to be around 3:30 p.m., and I don't think that this was like a full-on like autopsy. So, you know, the coroner didn't like full-on actually figure out his time of death. It was just like, from what he could see, he estimated 3:30.
I wonder how he gathered that though, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. So the rigor and liver mortis both take time to set in. So the fact that Christian's body had both indicates that there had at least been a couple of hours from his death to when he was, you know, looked at by police.
And he was indoors. So it wouldn't have like been, you know, the elements causing it to speed up.
Right. And again, police arrived at 5 p.m. So that's like when, you know, things for sure we know started happening because they arrived at 5 p.m.
Right.
On top of this, there was also a resident of the apartment that heard a gunshot around 12:30 that day. And she remembers hearing the gunshot around the time that she remembers because her son was like awake from a nap. And when she heard it, she like pulled him away from the window. So she's not 100% sure of the exact time, but she knows that it was much earlier than 3, 4 p.m. when, according to Dylan and Whitley, that's when it happened.
Right.
And a maintenance worker who this resident had told the gunshot about had later told her, oh, there was a suicide that day. So they kind of were like, she was like, okay, that definitely was a gunshot then. That wasn't just like a sound or something.
Right.
So with these two puzzle pieces, the culpable team and like investigator, you know, everybody kind of putting these pieces together, not the police, they determined that his death was likely sometime between 12 and 2 p.m. on February 26th, which is well before the 3:30 time thought beforehand.
And well before they got Chick-fil-A.
Exactly. It could have been after. It could have been around 2.
Yeah, true.
Not 100%. So. Hmm. So with this, many people, including the Andreacchio family, began to think that one or even two people were involved in his death. They did believe that Whitley and Dylan were there and somehow involved, but they don't think that the two of them would have been able to like fully overpower Christian enough to like kill him and make his death look like a suicide. So we're now going to talk about two persons of interest in this case and the accounts of why they're persons of interest. We don't know their names or the witness names. And I'm going to say now that no one has ever been identified as a suspect. No one has ever been charged. And all of what I'm saying in this case is alleged and is like my opinion or the facts of what has been reported from the family. And it also all comes from the Culpable podcast. Again, this really came from like their investigation into what happened. Mm-hmm. So the first witness was a friend of Ray, Christian's mom. So Ray was worried that something was going on with Christian and Whitley. And she had asked her friend to just keep an eye on his apartment because the friend lived a lot closer to the apartment than she did. And specifically, she asked the friend to keep an eye on Whitley while Christian was away on his hitch. Just make sure that she wasn't doing anything shady at the apartment, that kind of stuff.
Right.
So the friend would swing by. I don't know if it was every single day, but, you know, she would just keep an eye on it. And the day Christian died, Ray's friend had swung by the apartment to just, you know, check up. And around 1:30 p.m., she was driving by after she took her lunch break from work, and she saw two men exit the apartment building and enter a black pickup truck. And at first, she didn't think anything of it, and she actually assumed that one of them was Dylan because she knew that, like, Dylan was friends with Whitley, so maybe he was there. But after Christian's death, Ray was in her office and had the Facebook profile of a man that she was suspicious of. She had that profile pulled up on her computer, and this friend walked in and saw it on the screen and immediately was like, that's the man I saw. And she at first was like, is that Dylan? And Ray said, no, it's not. So again, we don't know his name, but I'm going to call him Truck Guy just to make things like less confusing.
Okay.
So this man, Truck Guy, Ray's friend was like, yep, that is the guy that I saw outside of the apartment. And this is somebody that Ray had already kind of been suspicious of. Mm-hmm. But this gets even crazier because a second account that this same man was involved in Christian's death came up. So this comes from a witness who worked on a boat that was owned by the same company that Christian worked for called Magnolia Marine. So like this man, you know, didn't work directly with Christian, but worked for the same company. So they all kind of knew each other. And I'm going to call this guy Boat Guy, just to like not
confuse things. Truck Guy, Boat Guy.
I know, I'm real creative. So Boat Guy had early on told the Andriacchios that he believed that Christian's car had been moved in the Magnolia Marine parking lot, which, as I mentioned earlier, Cheryl or Boat Mama had said the same thing. So he told the family this, but nothing really came of it. I mean, they couldn't really do much because police weren't doing much.
Yeah.
And he later brought this up to the Andriacchios' attorney, Cynthia. And when he reported this to her, Boat Guy also told her that he had had a conversation with another man, Hayes Mitchell, who also worked for the same company. And in his interview on Culpable, Boat Guy tells about how one day Hayes showed up to work under the influence of drugs and was talking about Christian being murdered. Mm. And Hayes said to him, quote, it wasn't supposed to happen that way. And as he was talking, he eventually mentioned Truck Guy.
Ooh.
And so Boat Guy was now telling Cynthia, hey, this other guy, Hayes, was talking about something bad happening to Christian, how it wasn't supposed to happen, and mentioned Truck Guy. According to Boat Guy, Hayes told him that Truck Guy and then some other guy that we don't know were there the day that Christian was murdered. And again, that, quote, it wasn't supposed to go down like that. But then at that point, Hayes figured out that Boat Guy knew Christian and like stopped talking to him about it and wouldn't bring it up again.
Wow.
So it's unclear what is true of all this. Hayes was, you know, on drugs, so you can't believe everything he says. But at the same time, why else would he be saying that? That's not, yeah. It's not something that you just make up or like are hallucinating about if nothing like that happened.
He may have twisted the details around, but there's some truth in that story, I think.
Yeah. So sadly, Hayes ended up overdosing a few years later, so we'll never know what exactly he knew. Mm-hmm. But one other super interesting fact about Hayes, his dad, Bilbo. His name is Bilbo. His dad, Bilbo, was the district attorney at the time of Christian's death.
Oh.
So, not going to say anything more about that, but take it as you will.
It's always interesting.
So, Ray took this information that Boat Guy had told the attorney, Cynthia, and that her friend had told her. She took this to the police, but they never went anywhere with it and specifically didn't do anything with it before Hayes passed away. So they could never interview him or figure out exactly what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. Ray at one point thought that it was maybe possible that these men had thought that Christian had money and were trying to rob him and it went wrong. You know, like that maybe Christian had fought back when trying to be robbed and that led to his death. And that's what Hayes meant when he said it went wrong. But that was just Ray's speculation at the time. And this didn't really go anywhere. And honestly, I don't think that like that's what happened because it would have been hard to like, if it was a robbery and then he accidentally died from a robbery, you wouldn't really be able to make it look like a suicide. So.
And that would be a huge coincidence if, because he wasn't even supposed to be there that day. If he was there, just so happened to be there the day that they were going to rob
him, exactly,
like his house or whatever.
So at this point, everybody's kind of at a standstill.
Guess who's back?
The gnat, your best friend. You should name him.
I'm gonna name him a pain in my ass. That's what I'm gonna name him.
Anyway, at this point, there was just nothing moving forward. You know, police were done with this, and the PIs, it just wasn't really moving forward. So this is where Dennis Cooper, his podcast, and his entire team really came into play. And before I go any further, I'm basically going to like recap what happened in the investigation that was like initially started by the culpable team. And it's like kind of crazy that a podcast is how more of this investigation happened. But at the same time, we've seen podcasts and social media influence lead to arrests, like in the Tara Grinstead case from the Up and Vanish podcast and Alyssa Turney's case through her sister, Sarah Turney.
Yep.
So again, I'd highly recommend you listen to Culpable to kind of follow along on the investigation, but I'm going to do my best to recap what was going on and the investigation that came from this podcast.
Okay.
So in 2018, Dennis knew a woman named Sheila Wysocki, and she just knew him from like, or knew her from, he knew her from other places. And so Dennis contacted Sheila and was like, hey, you know, we're looking into this. She was a PI. And she ended up connecting with Ray. And at the time, she couldn't take on Ray's, you know, or Christian's case because she just had a lot going on.
Yeah.
But she did offer some advice to Ray. And that was kind of where it went. And then one day, Sheila called Dennis and said, hey, I'm taking on the case. She finished up her other projects and she was like, okay, I am all in. And she went all in.
Yeah.
She assembled a team of like 8 private investigators and they set up an entire plan. They were like really going full on investigating this. So they wanted to meet with all of the important people in this case, including Dylan, Whitley, Jet, and Matt. So their first step was finding Whitley. Whitley was living down in Key West, Florida. So two of the PIs, Michael Kenny and Jay Marin, along with one of Jay's investigators, Claudia, and then Dennis and one of his producers, Jacob, they all headed down to Florida to find Whitley. They eventually located Whitley and approached her outside of a tanning salon, telling her that they were working on a production and wanted to talk to her. And she was like, what is this about? And they told her it has something to do with something that was on Crime Watch. So after they said that, she was like, okay, I don't want to talk to you. And she went to her car. But then they saw her putting on makeup in her car. And then she came back out and started talking to them. So like, you know, really, girl. So they explained to Whitley that they weren't the police and that they were a production company and they wanted to get her side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And she agreed and said that she could talk to them after her work shift that night and gave them her number and everything. And they set it up. But when the team visited her work that night, she wasn't there, and a coworker told them that she had called out of her shift. They then realized that she had deleted all of her social media accounts, and she didn't respond back to them or show up for their meeting. Which, like, okay, it's very sketchy. If you really had nothing to do with it,
yeah,
that's very sketchy. But also, Whitley was, like, you know, she wasn't, she was still kind of living, like, bouncing between places, and she just didn't, it doesn't seem like she fully had her life together, so maybe she just didn't want this coming back up.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I could see it from both sides. Like, if you didn't have anything to do with it, like, you've moved on, like, you're exhausted from dealing with it, not wanting to talk, but at the same time, if she went to go put on freaking makeup, you would think that she would want, like, the attention or something from it. So
yeah.
I don't know. It's very,
I don't know. Definitely weird.
Yeah.
But the trip to Florida wasn't a total bust. The team was able to meet with Whitley, one of Whitley's former landlords and a coworker of hers, Sam. And they then met with Sam's boyfriend, Doug, who also lived in the house with Whitley. And he recounted some of the encounters with Whitley, including her being violent towards him, not paying her rent, and being just very emotional and manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
So through these conversations, they were also able to get some information about Whitley's friend, Jordan, who was friends with Whitley back when Christian died and was now living down in Key West, Florida. the PI team really, really wanted to talk to Jordan because she had been interviewed back in 2016 when the NBI was conducting their investigation. And in that interview, Jordan kind of revealed some crazy shit. And again, this is just what she is saying, but let's go through it. So Jordan said in this interview that Whitley was using Christian, that she believed Whitley was using Christian for the money and living he was providing her, and that after Christian and Whitley moved in, Whitley started cheating on Christian with Jordan's ex-boyfriend, Matt Miller.
Matt Miller. Okay.
So, and then the interviewer asked her why she was cheating on, why Jordan thought Whitley was cheating on Christian. And Jordan said, quote, because it's Whitley Goodman. So, you know, just kind of speaks to her character.
She has a reputation for herself, I guess.
Yeah. Jordan also said that Christian was trying to catch her cheating and that he had a lot of trust issues with Whitley. Jordan said that Whitley and Dylan were kind of getting involved in like some shady stuff to make some more money. And Jordan said, quote, if Christian knew that Whitley wanted a part of that, he would have been done with her and she would have lost all of her luxuries. So that just kind of like indicates that Whitley was really getting a lot out of the relationship with Christian and maybe had a reason to not want to break it off.
Yeah.
Jordan recounts things that Whitley had told her and even admitted that she was really only friends with Whitley to get information out of her. Jordan believes that Christian did not commit suicide. And she said that Whitley told her after Christian's death, quote, I didn't mean to do it. It was a freak accident. I had to tell someone because it's eating me alive. Again, this is just Jordan's account. Hearsay. And we haven't heard this from anybody before. Right. But it's just interesting. Jordan also believes that Matt Miller knew something about what happens. What happened, not what happens. So that's what Jordan said back in 2016. So the PI team obviously wanted to interview her. They were able to locate her. They found her working at a local strip club and interviewed her that night off the record. But nothing really came from it, you know, besides what she had said in her 2016 statement. But she did say that her and Whitley weren't friends at the moment. And it was weird because Whitley had texted her that day about the PIs being in town. So they hadn't really been talking, but Whitley texted her, hey, these PIs are in town asking about this. So it was kind of weird, but nothing really came from that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Like, despite how crazy that interview was.
Yeah.
So after this trip to Florida, the team headed up to Meridian in Mississippi, and they split up to talk to everyone in town at once because they didn't want to like speak to one person and then that person tell somebody else that people are talking and that. So they split up and they wanted to talk to everybody. They spoke with Jet, who again maintained his story that Whitley had shot a gun the night before Christian's death. And one interesting thing that came from their conversation with Jet was that he knew the entry spot of the bullet on Christian's head. And he claimed that he heard it when the story aired on Crime Watch Daily, but they went back and listened to the crime or watched the Crime Watch Daily episode, and they never specifically detailed the bullet entry location. So it was kind of suspicious, but they couldn't really take anything from that.
Right.
So when they were trying to get Dylan to speak to him, he was avoiding them at all costs. He like, they knew he was home and he refused to open the door. And then his girlfriend would also like be like, what the heck are you guys doing? Stay away from us. So they were never able to talk to Dylan and nothing, you know, or get any information about him. While they were in Meridian, they also met up with Josh, Christian's brother, and they went to the former apartment where Christian had been killed. Dennis reported how shocked they all were with how small the apartment was. And while they were there, they even did a sound test to see how possible it would have been for Whitley to not hear the gunshot. And they shared that sound of the recording on the podcast, and it seems very unlikely that she would not have heard it.
Yeah. Well, she was also like zannied out too, so maybe, but I still feel like you would have heard something, even if you didn't necessarily wake up and like get up to investigate, like it would have roused you a little bit, you know?
Right. And, you know, I'll talk about this a little more later on, but she also, so Dylan claims that he woke her up by screaming from upstairs, Christian's dead. And Whitley claims that, or at first claimed that she was just like woken up by Dylan being like, hey, wake up. So how would you not hear a gunshot, but you'd be waken up by either one of those?
Yeah.
The last thing they did while in Meridian was talk to a former friend of Christian, Travis. Travis was in jail at the time for violating probation on a prior charge, and the team was able to interview him in jail. He was friends with Hayes Mitchell, who, if you remember, was the guy who told a coworker that things went wrong that night. And Travis did reveal that he one time had gotten pulled over when Hayes was driving and Hayes was drunk. And Hayes was basically able to like call up his dad, the district attorney, and get out of it. So just like indicating that, you know, there's definitely something going on there.
Strings can be pulled.
Mm-hmm. In May 2019, the PI team was able to track down Matt Miller, who moved to Connecticut, and they went and talked to him. They aired the interview on Culpable, and I'm going to recap it. As a little reminder, this is the guy that Whitley had been hanging out with, and this was the guy that Christian had found out about and was upset about, aka the reason that he came back early. Matt is also the one that claimed that Whitley did not shoot a gun the night before Christian's death. So according to Whitley, she was with Matt the night before Christian's death, but didn't remember a lot because she had taken Xanax. And according to Matt, she was there and she didn't shoot a gun. And he remembers that because he said that she was very afraid of the guns and was sitting in his lap while he covered her ears.
Right.
So he seems to remember that very specifically.
Which would align with what Christian's mom said, that like, she didn't think that she was the type to actually shoot the gun.
Mm-hmm. So during this 2019 interview, Matt learned for the first time, or at least claimed that he learned for the first time, that Whitley had tested positive for gunpowder residue on her hands.
Mm.
And he claimed to have not known that before 2019. And, you know, I kind of do believe him because he really wasn't involved in the investigation a ton.
Right.
He also revealed something that we had not known before. At one point, he was actually arrested as a suspect for murder. When he was arrested, he took a polygraph test, and it later came back as he was not lying. He had nothing to do with Christian's death, according to the polygraph test. So.
Oh, that's interesting that they did that with him and not other people.
I know. Matt talked about how around 1:30 or 2 p.m. on February 26th, he came home from work and fell asleep. And during the time he was asleep, he received 6 calls from Christian's phone. And like we talked about, he believes that it was Whitley trying to get a hold of him to come over to the apartment. And with this, he does not believe that Christian committed suicide. So just another person saying, I don't think it was suicide.
Yeah. And this is someone who has absolutely nothing to gain by saying that, you know, whereas like close family and friends, like, of course, they don't want to admit something like that. But that's pretty telling, I think.
Right. And with him being like almost a suspect at one point, like, it'd be better for him
if
it was a suicide because he couldn't be involved. So the last major thing that happened with the PI team was they got in contact with Captain Jay Arrington, who was a detective at the Meridian Police Department, and he had worked there for 30 years, and he had done a lot of work on Christian's case. So Sheila and another one of the PIs, Mark, got to actually go meet with him in person to talk to him about his views on the case. And during this meeting, Arrington was wearing a body cam. I'm not sure exactly why, just because he's a police officer and he's wearing a body cam. I don't know. But the audio from that meeting got leaked online. Hmm. And this is where things get kind of interesting. And yeah, you'll see.
Okay.
Arrington in this meeting agreed that the bullet hole in the wall and Christian's position when he was found did not indicate a suicide. In this leaked audio, we hear Arrington say that he thought the scene was altered at some point, saying, quote, I think once he was shot in the head, he was pulled over into the tub and the scene where he was originally shot at was cleaned up. Then Arrington referenced who he thinks is responsible for Christian's death, saying, quote, I think perhaps somebody took the wallet out of his pocket and that same somebody went down to the credit union trying to use his bank card to get his money out of the bank. aka Dylan. So this is just Arrington's, like, you know, his own opinion, but he basically thinks that Dylan was somehow involved in Christian's death, or at least Christian had died before Dylan went and used the bank card.
Right.
So now I'm going to explain what Arrington thought happened that day. Mm-hmm. He thought that Christian was holding the gun to his head and Dylan and or Whitley were trying to take it from him, as Dylan had done earlier that day, but it accidentally went off. Arrington did want to charge Dylan with manslaughter by culpable negligence, which basically means that, like, you didn't kill them, but you didn't stop it.
You didn't fess up to something bad happening. Yeah.
Right. He said that because Dylan gave him the gun back, knowing that Christian's mental state was not great and how he had earlier held the gun to his head, threatening to shoot himself, that could indicate manslaughter by culpable negligence. So he does not think that it was premeditated at all. He doesn't think that anybody planned it, but he does think that an accident happened and nobody has said what actually happened. He also thinks that there's no way Whitley would have slept through a gunshot, especially because she later woke up so, mm-hmm, quote unquote, easily. So would she really have slept through a gunshot? But to play devil's advocate, I have really random, like, sleep cycles, and sometimes I will sleep through everything and sometimes I will sleep through nothing. So, you know, I don't know, but I don't believe that she slept through it.
Yeah.
Arrington also does believe, from all of the evidence that we talked about earlier, that Christian died a lot earlier than 3:30, when, you know, Dylan and Whitley said that he, or would have indicated that he died based on when they discovered him.
Right.
This would be more consistent with what we saw from the livor mortis and the rigor mortis that we discussed. But unfortunately, Arrington never got to appear in front of a grand jury to talk about this theory, because the DA at the time, Bilbo Mitchell, or Hayes' father, did not allow him to present his case to the jury. Instead, Bilbo passed it off to the Attorney General's office, who brought it to the grand jury, and the result from that grand jury was ruled a suicide.
Which leads me to believe that Hayes had something to do with it and his dad was covering his ass for him. And I also I just can't wrap my mind around it being an accident, because if it was, that would be an even better story for them to cover what happened.
Yeah.
You know, because they could have been like,
that's true.
He had the gun to his head. We were trying to get it away and the gun went off and then, you know.
That's true. Yeah.
Oh, it was an accident.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't really think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't they call the police right then? It just, that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
The investigator over here.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about what happened, why Arrington didn't get to talk about this in front of the grand jury. But first, you have to know that after this meeting that Sheila and Mark had with Arrington, they were leaving the building and they ran into the current DA, the current police chief, and some other people from the Attorney General's office. And these people were going to have a meeting with Arrington, and the audio from that meeting was also leaked.
Oh.
So we're going to go through that now. So in this meeting, it was Arrington, the DA, Cassie Coleman, the Meridian Police Department current chief, Benny DuBose, two people from the Attorney General, Gypsy Ward and Tony Green, and then the Chief Administrative Officer, Richie McAllister. So they were all meeting with Jay, and that audio from that meeting was leaked. First off, Ward from the Attorney General's office claimed that they never tested some DNA that was found on the gun. And this was like a big point, because everybody was like, there was DNA found, why was it never tested? And Ward claimed that it was because the sample was so small that one test would completely destroy it and use all of it. And they wanted to keep the sample in case something like later came out that they needed to test, which is just like, seriously, to me, it sounds like you just don't want to like actually figure out what happened. And you just want to say it's a suicide and that's it.
Because all you need is one result, you know?
Yeah. Coleman, the current DA, you know, so Bilbo was the DA back when this happened. Now it was Coleman. She admitted during this meeting that the investigation was handled very poorly in the beginning and said, quote, I don't blame them for feeling like this system has failed them. I just think that at some point you have to trust that other people have looked into it, which is just so frustrating because, like, yes, they trust that other people have looked into it And a majority of those people, all of the PIs that have looked into it have said it was not a suicide.
Yeah.
So they are listening to the people.
Yeah. And the investigation from the police was not thorough.
Yeah. So as I just mentioned, Arrington did believe that Dylan should have been charged with culpable or manslaughter by culpable negligence. But the former DA, Bilbo Mitchell, passed the case off to the attorney general. And that meant that Arrington could not be, you know, present his case in front of the grand jury. And this whole thing was discussed between Coleman and Arrington in the meeting. So Coleman asked Ward from the attorney general's office if she felt like Dylan's culpability in the case was fully understood and considered by the grand jury. And Ward said, yes, I do feel like it was fully understood. I feel like the case was presented well, you know, to show them that it could have been manslaughter by culpable negligence. They also talked about how they literally showed a video of a suicide with the same weapon to the grand jury to prove that, like, there wouldn't be any gun splatter. And that's what really helped the jury move away from the manslaughter charge. But later, Josh Christian's brother talked about how, like, that video, it was, like, very old and blurry. You can't really see a ton. And you also don't know the caliber of, like, bullet that was shot. So even though it was the same gun that Christian used, it could have been different bullets, I guess. I don't know exactly how that works with guns, but he basically said, like, they shouldn't have, from that video, concluded that there's no way there would be blood splatter in Christian's death.
And didn't they find blood splatter on the ceiling with the luminol test? The
private investigator did.
Right. But mm-hmm. They didn't take that into consideration.
Nope. And they found that after the grand jury happened, because that was, like, way early on.
Okay.
So Tony Green from the AG's office said in the meeting that they were willing to turn the case back over to the DA and the police. He said, quote, "We're not going to answer to the Andriacchios. We're not going to answer to this podcast, this media. We never have, so we're not going to start now. This is between us," which, like, just pisses me off. I just want to be like, seriously?
They're mad because they're doing a better job than they can do.
Yeah, exactly. So the conclusion from this meeting was that the DA basically won't look into this again unless there is new evidence or information. She basically said the attorney general did a good job showing the grand jury the whole manslaughter by culpable negligence, and they came back with suicide. So unless there's new evidence or information that comes out, we're not going to do this again. Mm. Okay. We're almost through everything that happened in this case. Since Christian died in 2014.
Okay.
We're almost there. In July 2019, the AG office released Christian's case file to the public. All 4,000 pages, over 4,000 pages of the file were released.
Wow.
This included 911 calls, autopsy photos, all of it. And I'm going to go through a few of the things in the case file, but Dennis went through everything in episode 14 of Culpable. So if you want to hear everything, you can go listen to that. A lot of it is stuff that we've already seen and talked about.
Right.
But there was, he kind of walked through the file a little bit more clearly, but I'm not going to do that for this, for our episode. When this was initially, like, released to the public, Ray was very upset that the autopsy photos were released because, like, okay, why does the public need autopsy photos? Like, you can request to get a crime case and, like, have access to it, but the whole public does not need those autopsy photos.
Yeah.
Like, and she was just upset because she was like, that was, you know, something that
disrespectful,
yeah,
to the exactly. family, to Christian. Yeah.
So she, you know, she was very angry, but she harnessed that anger toward continuing the fight for justice for Christian.
Right.
Now, they did release the 911 call audio, and I did listen to it. It is very, very distressing, and so I'm not going to play it here, and I'm going to caution you if you do go listen to it. I'm going to recap it for you guys to get some of the major points, but just a warning, if you do go listen to it, it is very distressing. I literally had to, like, pause it and stop listening, halfway through to just, like, take a breather, because it's very distressing. So Dylan was the one who called 911, and he did sound very upset and distraught. Like, he definitely sounded like something had just happened. But again, you can sound one way, you know,
yeah.
you can make yourself sound a certain way.
Yeah.
During the call, you can hear Whitley screaming and crying in the background, and the operator had told them to try not to touch anything. Also, at one point, without being prompted, Dylan told the 911 operator, "I went to the store and I came back and thought he was taking a shower." So, like, I find that kind of weird that you're, like, on the phone with 911 because you just found your friend dead and you're like, "I just went to the store and I came back."
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. They also, like, immediately said, Dylan said, you know, "I need to report a suicide." So, like, immediately they were like, "He killed himself," yeah, on the phone.
Right.
Which, like, okay, if you found your friend dead in a closed door bathroom, that's probably what you would assume. But, you know, it just, it's interesting that that was what they said.
Yeah.
So Dylan kept saying that he needed to call Christian's family. And so once the 911 operator had the information, she was like, "You can hang up and call the family if you need. Like, I have all the information." And I believe, in my opinion, that's where the phone calls came from after Dylan found Christian before the police arrived.
Okay.
So Dennis Inculpable said that his takeaway from the case file is that the case made to the grand jury was definitely swaying more towards suicide, with not a lot of evidence of it actually being a suicide. And Josh, Christian's brother, agreed with that. There were also two jurors who have come out and, you know, anonymously, but they described the case as skewed towards suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it definitely seems like it was whatever the AG presented to the grand jury in to show,
yeah,
if it was manslaughter or suicide, was leaning more towards suicide.
And they're not supposed to do that. They're not supposed to skew it one way or the other.
The guy who at the time Culpable was being produced was currently running against Coleman for the DA position, said that he believed that the case should be reopened and reinvestigated. So I actually didn't look up if this guy won or not. I'm assuming the election's over, so I probably should have looked that up. But, you know, Coleman, the current DA, was like, it's as where we're at now, unless there's new evidence, we're done. And this guy who was running against her was like, "No, I think it should be reopened."
Yeah.
Okay. So we've gone through a lot in this case. This is going to be like an hour and a half episode. I am going to wrap it up by sharing my opinion, and I want to emphasize that this is my opinion. I am not blaming anybody. I'm not saying that anybody did anything. This is just my opinion and what I think happened. I think that Christian did not commit suicide, which, like, I came to that conclusion very early on. I also 100% believe that he died significantly earlier than when the 911 call was made, as proven by the liver and rigor mortis and the witness who heard the gunshot. And I think that he was moved in some way because of that liver mortis. I just don't think that you can dispute that.
No, not at all.
I personally am leaning more towards the scenario that possibly Christian was threatening to shoot himself and Dylan and or Whitley attempted to take the gun away. The gun went off and killed Christian. It could have even been that one of them was actually holding it when it went off. So maybe that's why they wanted to cover it up. You know, they were young. They were scared, probably. And, you know, you brought up a good point earlier saying, like, why wouldn't they just tell that? But if they were that freaked out, you know, in the moment, maybe they decided they needed to come up with a story and didn't want to risk them being involved at all. I don't know, which, like, is dumb, but also to us, because we know so much about true crime, we're like, okay, why would you do that?
Right.
But maybe if somebody doesn't, you're like, they're going to immediately think that I killed him and I'm going to be charged for murder. I don't know.
Right.
So I think that some sort of accident happened, but instead of reporting what happened, Whitley and Dylan did some sort of cleanup or manipulation of the crime scene to make it look like Christian killed himself alone in the bathroom. I also think that it's possible that they called others in distress to, like, help them figure out what to do, which kind of brings in some of the other people we talked about. But I also am not 100% sure on that. They could have just talked to people afterwards as well.
Yeah.
I think I find that a little more likely. But I really just can't get past the scientific evidence. And then also the inconsistency in their alibis and their stories is just too much for me. And that's what led to my personal conclusion.
Yeah.
So that's my opinion. And I also want to hear, like, what you guys think happened, because I feel like like, even just talking to you, Andrea, you brought up a point I didn't think about. So I really want to like hear what our listeners have to say. So I will be sure to post this podcast or this case on our Facebook group, our Instagram, and our YouTube channel so we can discuss. So we have a Facebook group and YouTube channel. They're both called Inhuman Podcast. So I'll post there, and I would love to hear what your guys' thoughts are. If you think it was an accident, if you think it was a murder, if you think it was a suicide, whatever you think. And then I'll also post it on Instagram, and you can find us there at @inhuman_podcast. So please, please, please let us know your thoughts, because this is one that I'm just like, I'm so curious what others think.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's more to the story than is given to us, you know, and just the fact that like that Hayes guy, his dad, and I don't know, there's just so many shady areas to the story. It just, I definitely agree with you. I do not think at all whatsoever that Christian committed suicide at all.
Yeah, I agree. I also want to say my heart and admiration goes out to Ray Andriacchio and the entire Andriacchio family, especially for their refusal to give up and to get justice for Christian. I'm yes. sure half of the time it would be easier to just drop it and get past it, but they have not given up, and it is incredible how strong they are.
Yeah.
And this family really just deserves to know what happened to their son.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, for the millionth time, I highly recommend you listen to Culpable, because there are a ton more details. I want to give them credit for all like yeah. doing most of my research, because that's where I got most of my information. And I did do my best to cover fully and clearly a lot of the details. So I hope you guys found it informational and interesting, but there are a ton more details in Culpable.
Yeah.
Also, please share and continue getting more attention to this case so that the family can get justice, because the more pressure we put on the police yep. department, the more like out there about this case, the more people talking about it, the better the chances are that something will come up.
Feel that heat on them. Yeah.
Yeah. In the words of Ray, we need to stay motivated and invigorated for change. We can make a difference, and we can do this for Christian and other victims.
Absolutely.
And that is the mysterious, complicated case of Christian Andriacchio. I hope it wasn't too complicated. I'm sorry for how long it was. But that is all I have for you guys today. If you enjoyed, don't forget to share and also subscribe. If you're not already, leave us a rating.
Yes.
We're almost at our, well, we're sort of almost getting closer to our goal of 50 by the end of the year. So yeah. If you're listening, leave us a rating, and we will see you next week. I don't know. I think you are too, Andrea, but I am going to cover a solved case because I need a break from like,
I know,
this type of like research. Yeah. So there will be at least one solved case next week.
Yes. Give you guys some resolution.
Yes. I need some resolution. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So yeah, until next week, keep it human.
Bye.
Bye.